and left in an abandoned mine shaft. Groot Vlei is jointly owned by Nelson Mandela's grandson, Zondwa, and President Zuma's nephew, Kulubuse. South African trade unions say there's a dispute over non-payment of mine employees, but it's not clear whether the dead were unpaid Aurora mine personnel or illegal miners. Ofebia Kwistarkton, NPR News, Dakar.
Heavy rain falling in Russia today is helping fire crews battling hundreds of wildfires there. The smog generated by the blazes near Moscow has generally cleared, but forecasters are warning it could return if the winds change direction. A new wildfire has broken out near Russia's top nuclear research facility. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world on the web at hewlett.org.
Programs on WILL are made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Agrigold Hybrids, Muhammad, Anderson Foundation, First National Bank and Trust Company, Clinton, and Michael W. Walker Consulting, Urbana. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
Well, good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. I am sorry to say that we were not able to make contact with our scheduled guest for this hour. We were going to be talking with David Cloud. He's a national security reporter with the Los Angeles Times, and we were going to talk about a recent book that he co-authored. The title of the book is The Fourth Star. It's a book that profiles four of the U.S. Army's most influential generals, among them David Petraeus. And the book tries to use the stories of the four to explore changes in the military since the Vietnam. I'm sorry that we weren't able to find him. We'll see if we can get that program rescheduled, and we'll have the conversation on another day. Instead, we'll go to the Focus Archives. We've picked a program here that has nothing to do with war or defense policy. It's a conversation we had back in June with music historian Harvey Sachs talking about Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. So I hope you'll enjoy listening, and keep in mind that this hour will not take calls. Beethoven's Ninth Symphony is one of the most recognizable compositions in all of the history of Western music. With its dramatic final movement for orchestra and chorus, the Ninth has become a symbol of freedom and joy. Interestingly enough, it's a work that was born in a very repressive era, and it was something that, well, now it's regarded as something of a standard. It was something that, when it was premiered, it was so unorthodox that listeners were both amazed and confused. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we'll talk about the Ninth Symphony, about Beethoven, something about what was going on in the world when that symphony was first performed. And our guest is Harvey Sachs. He's a writer and music historian and is the author of a newly published book, which is titled The Ninth, Beethoven and the World in 1824. Random House is the publisher. Harvey Sachs is writer, has co-author of eight previous books, author or co-author of eight previous books, of which there have been more than 50 editions in 15 languages. He's also written for The New Yorker and many other publications, and he is currently on the faculty of the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia. He's joining us by telephone. And Mr. Sachs, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I am fine. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Certainly
there are a number of major, if one wanted to write an entire book about a major piece of music and the composer and what was happening, I suppose one could pick various sorts of things. For you, does the Ninth Symphony have some particular significance?
Well, yes, it certainly does. So do many other compositions, I have to say. But when I was, the origin of this book is that I had just finished writing another one, and a friend said to me at the time, why don't you try picking a year that was both historically important and in which something important happened in the world of music. And I thought about several possibilities, and I fixed on this one.
Hmm. Well, so maybe talk just that we can talk some more about this, but just as a way of starting into that, 1824, what was important about that year?
You know, there, of course, one could pick any year in history and find some important events and so on. Excuse me. But the fact is that 1824 was the year in which Lord Byron died at Missolonghi in attempting to aid the Greeks in their struggle for independence from Turkey. many other things were going on in the world of arts and culture, but also politically, the interesting, perhaps most interesting point as far as the Ninth Symphony is concerned, and you touched on it in your introduction, is that here is Beethoven writing a tribute, in a way, an encouragement, an incitement to humanity to unite, and, you know, all men will become brothers, and freedom and joy and so on, in the midst of, and in the very city in which Metternich was perfecting, in effect, the first modern police state. This came after, you know, in the wake of the French Revolution, the Napoleonic Wars. The monarchs who had either been unseated or had held on to their thrones in a very shaky way during the previous decades had returned to power and were intent on keeping power. And so they instituted a series of repressive measures in most of the countries that had been fighting against France, and also in France itself with the return of the Bourbon dynasty. Mm.
Do you think that there are some ways in which Beethoven represented a different kind of composer, someone, something that hadn't really existed before?
Absolutely. Beethoven really changed the not only the course of music, he changed the whole idea of what a composer was. Before his time, you know, there were composers who were just as great as Beethoven. We're talking about Bach and Mozart and so on. but all of them had worked more or less for, excuse me, I have this, I have to keep clearing my throat. I have a sort of sinus infection. They had worked for either princes of the church or counts and, you know, royalty, and had sort of kowtowed to their various masters. They were considered servants, in fact. And Mozart broke the mold in the early 1780s by refusing to work for the Archbishop of Salzburg and going to Vienna and working more or less as a freelance composer. But even there, he had to write on commission. Now, Beethoven also wrote on commission and depended on aristocratic patrons, but essentially he wrote exactly what he wanted to write. And you know, people didn't say to him, "I need a divertimento for a party that I'm giving next weekend. Would you please crank one out for me?" Mm-hmm. He received patronage from aristocrats and simply wrote what he wanted, basically when he wanted to write it. So the whole idea of the genius artist, as far as composers, musicians were concerned, sort of is born with Beethoven.
Yeah. And he apparently also, in a way that composers before him hadn't really done, he, and perhaps this was something that was particularly true of Beethoven as he was getting near the end of his life, he actually thought about the fact that one day he would be gone, but the music would live on. He actually thought about his legacy.
Absolutely. Beethoven wrote for posterity. Mm-hmm. And he also, of course, wanted very much to be appreciated in his own time. But especially in his last years, he was writing for himself and for those who would come after. And this was, as you say, this was something really new. Until then, until Beethoven's time, well, it also, I should explain, that it has a lot to do with the rise of the middle class, the bourgeoisie, and the rise of what in the German-speaking countries was called Hausmusik, domestic music making. You know, they didn't have home entertainment systems in those days. So there was a greater and greater interest in making music in the home. Every even lower middle class home had a piano in it. And so the demand for printed music became great. Now, you know, through the 18th century, even in the time of Haydn and Mozart, publishing a piece of music was relatively rare. It became less and less rare as the century came to a close, but it was still relatively rare for them to publish their works. And even when they did publish them, their idea was to disseminate them among the music-loving people of that day, and not necessarily thinking that, you know, this was going to last for centuries. I think that Bach and Haydn and Mozart would be thrilled to know that their music has lasted and is listened to by more people, far more, I mean, geometrically more people today than in their own time. But they would also be shocked to know that. Whereas for Beethoven, the idea of writing for posterity was something very, very present in him, and that's why he also did not mind writing things that were, that he knew would be almost beyond the abilities of musicians and singers of his day to perform.
Our guest in this hour is Harvey Sachs. He's a writer and music historian. He's authored a number of books. His most recent is The Ninth, Beethoven and the World in 1824. It's about the composer. It's about his Ninth Symphony. And it's also about what was happening in the world at that time, 1824. Random House is the publisher. It's just out. Questions, comments, certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. The Ninth has become something of a standard of the classical repertoire, and you know, who knows how many times around the world every year the work is performed. And everyone has heard it more than once, no doubt. And so what we cannot have is the experience of hearing it with fresh ears, as if you'd never heard it before. Can you, though, imagine what it would have been like for the people at the premiere to be hearing this piece?
Yes. In the first place, we know that the premiere, the first performance, which took place on May 7th, 1824 in Vienna, cannot have been performed very well at all. It must have, in fact, been horrific, because it was a mixture of amateur and professional musicians. The vocal parts are tremendously difficult even today, and would have been considered almost insane in Beethoven's day. The rehearsal time was extremely limited. I believe they had only two ensemble rehearsals for the entire performance, which included, by the way, not only the Ninth Symphony, but the first performance of three sections of his great Missa Solemnis, his final religious work, and an overture that's also quite difficult to play. So it was a huge concert by modern-day standards. It probably was about between 2.5 and 3 hours of music, and all of it new. So it can't have been performed well. That we know that, and contemporary accounts demonstrate that even though their standards of performance were much lower than ours are, they still understood that it was not being performed well. I think one critic wrote the singers did what they could. That was his lapidary comment on what took place. On the other hand, Beethoven, who was 53 years old at the time, which was relatively old in those days, I think the average life expectancy of a Viennese male in those days was certainly not over 50. Beethoven was the most highly respected living composer in Europe, and he had not given a public concert in several years. So the house was packed, and there was great enthusiasm for Beethoven, I would say, much more than for any conceivable understanding of the music that was being performed. Mm.
Well, even if it was a competent performance, it would have been something, a work of a type that people had not heard before, this kind of incorporation of the vocalists and the chorus in a symphonic work hadn't been done before. And perhaps just the nature of the work, its construction, the kinds of things that Beethoven did, to those people at that time, this would have been these musical ideas would have been new.
That's right. It was by far the longest symphony that had ever been written. It's a little over an hour, anywhere from, let's say, 63 to 70 minutes, depending on the tempi that the conductor chooses. As you say, it was the first symphony to incorporate the human voice into it. And not only that, but, as the length sort of suggests, each movement is much broader in proportions than parallel movements in earlier symphonies, including Beethoven's own previous eight symphonies, had been. So there's that to begin with. Then, on top of that, you have harmonic advances in the work that were highly, highly original. And I could go into great technical detail here, but that's, I don't think this is the proper place for it. But, you know, the fact that the symphony begins, the first movement of the symphony begins in a very ambiguous key. You're not sure. I mean, we are because we've heard it many times, but a listener coming fresh to this piece would not be sure even where the home base in the first movement is until nearly a minute into the performance. So in many, many ways, it was highly, highly original and shocking, I'm sure, yeah, to early listeners. And many people said, well, you know, Beethoven is deaf now, and he doesn't know what he's doing, and too bad, poor old Beethoven, you know, wrote some pretty good stuff when he was younger, but now he's kind of flipped. So, unfortunately, that was, in fact, the reaction. Even a commentator like the poet Heinrich Heine, who, by the way, was from the same part of Germany that Beethoven was from, even though he was about a generation younger, he, even years after Beethoven's death, said, well, you know, we have to excuse him for those last works because he couldn't hear, and, he must have been a little bit crazy, too.
Yeah, yeah, it seems what I find myself thinking about, not necessarily in connection with this work, but stories that you read about particular pieces of music, when they were first performed, they were so outrageous, so provocative that they literally started riots. Nowadays, unless you are really willing to expose yourself to very avant-garde experimental music, I'm not sure that it's possible to have that kind of experience with a piece of music that it would be so shocking that you would have to say, I had never heard anything like this before, and maybe that it would provoke some kind of extreme emotional reaction in the listener. It seems that it's just not an experience one can have anymore.
Well, that's also because in the 20th century, certainly from the middle, well, even from, let's say, the 1920s on, with composers like Schoenberg and his followers and so on. And then the next wave of composers like Boulez and Stockhausen, composers actually invented their own musical languages as they went along, which is much more revolutionary than what Beethoven was doing. And so we've become accustomed, those of us who are, you know, deeply involved in the so-called classical music world, we're accustomed to going to concerts of new music in which we expect, or maybe not with always with the greatest of enthusiasm, but we actually expect to be lost, to not understand the musical language of some composers. Now, that's certainly not true of all. There are schools of composers who are much more conservative. But we're not surprised to go to a concert at which all the tables are constantly being turned. Until, I would say, the early 20th century, that was not the case. The musical language was expected to evolve, yes, not to remain stagnant, but to evolve in a kind of natural way. Now, the great revolutionaries, to my way of thinking, in music history are, in the first place, Beethoven, and then Wagner in the middle of the 19th century, and then Stravinsky, especially with the premiere of The Rite of Spring in Paris in 1913, again, shocked audiences because, I think more than any other reason, because the emphasis in music had been shifted at that point from harmony to rhythm, these violent rhythms. Some people still find The Rite of Spring and works of that genre to be revolutionary and shocking today. Mm-hmm. But in any case, Beethoven's musical language, we can see now, evolved very naturally from what came before in his own works and in the works of his predecessors. Still, the works of his late period, the Missa Solemnis, the Ninth Symphony, the last three piano sonatas, or even last five or six piano sonatas, and certainly the last five string quartets and the Diabelli variations for piano, these were all very, very experimental, we could almost say, for their time, yeah. And certainly left most listeners of his own day in a cloud of dust.
Well, and I think even now, and I think at least one of the reviewers of the book made a point something like this, that we would, of course, people would say, yes, of course, Beethoven was a great composer, one of the great figures of Western music, at the same time that he is sometimes kind of hard to like. And if you ask people, what would you rather hear, would you rather hear Mozart or would you rather hear Beethoven? Well, I think probably a lot of people say, well, I'd rather hear Mozart, or maybe Brahms or Schubert or Schumann, or, and that there is something about Beethoven, and maybe particularly this is true of his later compositions, that's kind of edgy and maybe a little bit discomforting, even for us now.
Well, Beethoven insists on having your attention. I hate, like most musicians, I hate background music in general. So I certainly don't want to hear Bach or Mozart while I'm eating dinner, because they're more interesting than whatever I'm eating. But you can imagine sort of euphonious music going on in the background, it's very hard to imagine being able to concentrate on anything else than what's happening musically when something by Beethoven is being performed, because he grabs your attention. The ego is very, very strong in his music making. I mean, it is in every great composer's works, but not in a way that that insists on, that sort of takes you by the throat and says, listen to this, I'm trying to tell you something very, very important. Mm-hmm. So, that's absolutely correct what you said. It's not just edgy, it's more than that. It's It's saying, I have something really important to tell you, and you have to listen to this.
And again, I think that goes back to some of the things that you're talking about earlier, the things that separate Beethoven from other composers, and it is that quality of his an urgent need to say something, to have something to say, and you know that's you know perhaps there some earlier composers, particularly with sacred music, you would say, well, they definitely say something, or there's a particular spirit that they're trying to convey, or a particular place that they're trying to get the listener to go, but that yet still there's something different about that intent to convey these really powerful, sometimes difficult emotional forces that are churning around inside the composer. In doing that and trying to put that on the page and then put that in the ear of the listener, that Beethoven was doing something that really nobody had done before.
That's absolutely right. The other factor, of course, that's very important is the use of words in the Ninth Symphony. Mm-hmm. Any piece of music that has words within it, whether it's an opera or a piece of religious music or a song, whatever, the words tell you what you're expected to feel at that point. So they guide you. I feel, and I think probably most musicians would agree with me, that whatever piece of music, a piece of great music, whatever piece of music I'm listening to, I feel that it is telling me something very specific, but it's not verbal. And maybe it shifts, but maybe my own opinion on what it's telling me, even though I'm not verbalizing it, shifts from one listening to the next. Maybe it makes a different kind of impression on me from one listening to the next. But still, there is that very strong guiding hand, and of course, could not be more true also in Bach and in Haydn and in Mozart and all the great composers before and after Beethoven. Mm-hmm. But with Beethoven, the degree of intentionality, as we were saying before, of his insisting that you perceive the music as he wants you to perceive it, whatever that may be, and of course we can never be sure, that is very, very strong in him. Mm-hmm.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Harvey Sachs. He's a writer and music historian. He's written for The New Yorker and many other publications. He's currently on the faculty of the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia. He's the author of a number of books, and his most recent is The Ninth, Beethoven and the World in 1824. It's published by Random House, and as we have discussed, it is in part about Beethoven and his life and his work, about this particular work, his last symphony that was premiered just a few years before the composer's death, and also something about what was happening in the world at that time in 1824, and perhaps how the work itself was reflective of a certain kind of a spirit or of a certain kind of an impulse that was being expressed not just in music but by other artists as well of the time. We have a caller here in Champaign County, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi. You were talking about the history of the time is what I was going to get at, I guess, try to. And you were saying that this was at the time of the Greek defense or liberation struggle against the Ottomans, if you want to call it a little language from a later era. But it seems to me that I know you focused on that one, but there was the renaming of the Eroica, which was previously dedicated to Napoleon. Do I have that right?
Yes.
I wonder whether it's the problem with topicality, I guess, is that sometimes you have to revise and correct. I know you want to say something, but I wanted to get one last thing in.
Sure. No, go ahead.
The times were so This was a European fascination with the liberation of the Greeks, who were very Balkan. Who, you know, in some ways, the historicity or the glorification of ancient Greece was sort of a misunderstanding of the culture too, because all those white sculptures that we revere as Greek sculpture were actually painted very gaudily, brilliantly pastel and different colors. So I know that the host has had a show about that in previous times, but there's sort of a misinterpretation. But there's another detail from the time, which is that my understanding, I think I verified it a while back, is that the fraternity system in Europe was basically a material aid campaign to the Greeks against the Ottomans, and that so this is sort of the legacy of on the university campuses was the Greek system, which obviously it's got very little to do with ancient Greeks or the Greeks even of that Ottoman time. So that's a little inchoate, but hopefully you can react and sort of maybe outline some of the other features of that time.
Yes. I don't know much, if anything, about the Greek letter societies that became, you know, fraternities and so on. Certainly the Greek liberation movement was part and parcel of the Romantic movement in Europe, and at that time, in the 1820s especially. And by the way, and I do mention this in my book, you know, the famous Monroe Doctrine, which was December 1823, just while Beethoven was in the final phases of completing the Ninth Symphony. The Monroe Doctrine is one little paragraph in James Monroe's message to Congress, and I suppose it's what we would call the State of the Union address now. In that same message, Monroe all of a sudden turns to the Greek situation, and without ever mentioning Turkey, he talks about favoring the Greek liberation movement. So this was, you know, this was very much in the air at the time. This is, you know, sort of wandering from the subject, the direct subject of Beethoven, but it was, you know, certainly Byron was there. He used part of his wealth to raise an army. He went to Missolonghi in Greece to try to unite the various Greek factions, and died of disease in the attempt. And Delacroix in Paris, the great painter, was in 1824 began and completed his famous painting which is now in the Louvre, of the massacres at Chios, which again was about the Turks and the Greeks. And so my feeling about that whole movement, apart from, you know, no doubt sincerity on the part of the people who were interested in supporting the Greek cause, is that it was a way of showing support for a movement of liberation, which they could not do at home because their own governments were too repressive. They couldn't fight for their own liberation in their respective countries, but they could do it for faraway Greece, also because the Greeks were Christians and the Ottomans were not. They were Muslims. And so the European governments couldn't very well oppose, even though they didn't take part directly, they as Christian governments, they couldn't oppose support among individual Europeans for the Greek cause. So that's an answer, I hope, mm-hmm. at least in part, to one of the points of the caller raised. As far as the Eroica Symphony is concerned, that was 20 years before the Ninth Symphony. That was 1804, basically. And yes, Beethoven had originally intended to dedicate this Third Symphony in E-flat major, which was also a very revolutionary work in its day, to General Bonaparte, whom he saw at the time as bringing the French Revolution across Europe. But in 1804, as the symphony was being completed, or after it had just been completed, Napoleon declared himself, crowned himself emperor. And at that point, Beethoven realized that Napoleon was, you know, in it for personal ambition, like all the others. And so he crossed out the dedication to Bonaparte, which it said on originally on the dedicatory page of the symphony, the manuscript, and wrote, dedicated to the memory of a great hero, Eroe. So that's how the nickname Eroica became attached to the symphony.
Other questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Probably, of, I mentioned at the beginning that this is certainly a very well-known work, and of the work itself, probably the part that's most recognizable and most familiar to people will be the final movement. This big setting for orchestra and chorus, which is a setting of Schiller's poem by Friedrich Schiller, the German poet. This was something apparently that Beethoven, for some years before composing this, he had been thinking about wanting to take this text and set it to music. And having, you know, knowing what that poem is, something about what the poem is about, and having said something about the political atmosphere of the time, gets me to asking the question, well, just exactly what sort of political statement, or how much of a political statement was Beethoven intending to make with this work?
I don't think that he saw it as a specific political statement, specifically aimed at, you know, the present-day situation of his time or anything of that sort. I think he saw it as a universalizing piece of poetry that he then wished to make apparent also in the music that he was writing for it. Yes, he had been familiar with the poem since his early 20s, in other words, for 30 years. And at some point, while he was working on the Ninth Symphony, he realized that this was perhaps the moment when he could make use of that text and set it to music in a way worthy of the importance that he attached to that particular poem. Mm-hmm. Now, the poem itself is actually a drinking song. It's a sort of dithyrambic, bacchanalian type of poetry. And Beethoven really took bits of it. He didn't, you know, a lot of people seem to think that this is the poem as Schiller wrote it, and Beethoven just took it and said it. Beethoven used bits of it and rearranged them to suit his musical purposes. So whether or not Schiller, who was long gone by that time, would have approved or not, we don't know. But copyright laws weren't very strong in those days, so I guess it didn't make much difference. But another thing that Beethoven did with the text, the very first line that's sung in the symphony, in the finale of the symphony, is not from Schiller's poem. Beethoven wrote it himself. He wrote the words, "O Freunde, nicht diese Töne," "O friends, no more these sounds, but let us rather intone more agreeably and more joyfully." So what he's saying there, because the beginning of the last movement makes use of themes from the first three movements, and each of those is discarded. And when he gets to the bass baritone's first line, Beethoven is telling us, we don't want these anymore. We want something better. We want something that's both more pleasant and more joyful. Mm. And as far as the political aspect of what he's saying is concerned, it's a very generalized and overriding and almost overwhelming attempt to demonstrate that all human beings, that we're all in the same boat, you know, and that we have to unite, that that's the only way is to unite. It's not to separate and fight. It's to unite. And that those who do that will receive joy as their reward. Beethoven was perfectly well aware that this was not going to happen, that this was totally unrealistic in his time, and unfortunately it's totally unrealistic in our time. But the political aspect of what he was saying was to go way beyond anything that could possibly have been achieved or even imagined in his day.
We are moving into about our last 10 minutes in this hour of focus. And again, we're talking with Harvey Sachs, author of the book The Ninth, Beethoven and the World in 1824, published by Random House, just out. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Beethoven, when he finished this work, was 53, and I think, as you pointed out a little bit earlier, he was an old man for his time. I think he lived only another 3 years after this, and was and had been for a number of years at this point, at the point of the premiere, had been deaf. You also mentioned earlier in the interview that some people who found the music difficult, they attributed it to his deafness. Someone said, "Well, the poor man, he's deaf. He doesn't know what he's doing. He can't hear it," as if it somehow was a mistake. Do you think there were, however, some ways in which his deafness, and I don't mean in a negative way, but if you can say it in a positive way, his deafness actually contributed to the work.
Oh, absolutely. Beethoven, and in my book, I quote Joseph Brodsky, the Russian poet, who talks about exile. And, you know, for Beethoven, deafness was exile. I mean, you know, the common picture of Beethoven as this eccentric, very difficult, rough-hewn guy who wandered around Vienna with notebooks and sheafs of music writing paper sticking out of his pockets and was oblivious to what was going on around him and was not the cleanest guy in the world and certainly not the neatest. This is from his later years when his deafness had become so acute as to be virtually total. And so he, who had earlier in life, he had wanted to marry, he had wanted to be a father, he had wanted to be part of human society. From the time his deafness began to become noticeable when he was 30-ish, even a little bit before that, through its progression, he became gradually more sensitive to that condition and withdrawn, in a way, from human society. Today he probably would have had a hearing aid, and would not necessarily have happened. But in his day, the deafness, really by 18, the deafness was virtually complete. Mm-hmm. He could hear extremely loud noises, but nothing else. And so he was really withdrawn from human society, basically. When he went out, he could be very sociable. He had a wonderful sense of humor and so on. When he went out with friends, he carried with him notebooks that they could write in to tell him what they wanted to say to him. Fortunately, most of those notebooks have been preserved, so we know what he was doing, who he was talking to, even though we don't have his comments, which were spoken in the most cases. We have a lot of information about him through those notebooks. In any case, it was through this isolation, this exile, that he developed entirely in his own unique direction. There were no superimpositions from the outside, in a sense. Not that he did not want his music to be performed. He certainly did want it to be performed and, if possible, understood. But the deafness, the isolation, pushed him towards a way of expressing himself that was entirely free for him. He felt no restrictions or restraints in the procedure, what he was doing. He simply wrote what he needed to write. And perhaps if he hadn't had this tragic isolation from other human beings, that might not have happened. In fact, I'm sure his life would have taken an entirely different course if it had not been for the deafness.
And you feel confident that he was gifted enough as a musician and composer so that these late works that he had composed passed after the point where he could hear that in his head, he could hear the music. He knew what it would have sounded like had he been able to actually hear it.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, many composers who are not deaf write music, you know, not sitting at the piano. You know, we have those old films about Liszt and Schumann and so on, where they sit at the piano and sort of pick out melodies until they find the right one. You know, that's complete nonsense. I mean, some composers, Stravinsky, for instance, did compose sitting at the piano, but the idea is already in the head before they sit at the piano. Mm-hmm. And many of them, you know, would not have a piano at all, or maybe only to try things out after they had already composed. Because any completely, thoroughly trained musician can look at a score, a piece of music, and hear it. So, you know, this was not unique to Beethoven because of his deafness. It's the deafness is what created the isolation, the feeling of exile, and allowed him, I think, to take paths that he might not otherwise have done.
There is this story about the premiere that when the work was concluded, that the audience stood up, started to applaud, and that Beethoven had his back to the audience and, of course, could not hear them, and that someone had to take him and turn him around so he could face the audience so he could, in fact, see the response to the piece. Did that actually happen?
Yes, for once there's actually an anecdote that we know is true. This happened. We don't know for sure whether it was at the end of the symphony or after the second movement, but it was the contralto, Carolina Unger, who sang at the first performance, the solo, one of the four soloists in the first performance, who did that. You know, the audience was cheering and applauding, and he was still looking at the score, you know, sort of imagining the music in his head. He was on the stage. One of, by the way, three people who were sort of conducting the performance, and she took him by the sleeve and turned him around to show him that the audience was, you know, they were throwing their hats and handkerchiefs in the air and so on. It's very, very touching to think about that, you know, that this poor guy who had given so much couldn't even really hear the enthusiasm of the people who were listening to his music.
Yeah. The work, it's something that has become associated with momentous occasions, things that are both, that have both elements of solemnity and joy in them both. And for example, when the Berlin Wall fell, Bernstein conducted the work, and it's has that sort of association. And I wonder, at what point did it start to get that association, that people thought about it being, that if you were going to perform some kind of work at that kind of occasion, that's one of the things that you would think about doing?
Certainly, you know, by, I would say, the 1860s or thereabouts, when Wagner built his theater at Bayreuth in Germany, when the cornerstone was set for the building, he conducted a performance of the Ninth Symphony to mark the occasion. And it's been used very much ever since. I think it that might have happened even earlier, but it was considered too hard to perform until the mid 19th century. But it did become a very a ceremonial piece in a way. And I have to say that in part that's due to a misunderstanding. The first three movements, which constitute well over half the length of the symphony, are not an ode to joy in any sense. Mm-hmm. They are, the first movement is extremely dramatic, despairing, catastrophic. The second movement is perhaps, it can perhaps be seen as a sort of protest, combat, and the third movement as a sort of acceptance of destiny. If you want to read into a piece of abstract music some kind of meaning, it's really only the finale and especially the famous Ode to Joy theme that people have adopted as a symbol of joy, which is, of course, correct.
Well, we're here at the point we have to finish, and I guess I thought rather than at some point here during the program just doing what I could do and playing just a minute or two of the piece, I guess I would just encourage people to, if you have a recording in your collection, find some time and pull it out if you haven't listened to it in a while, or if you have to go down to the library and find yourself recording, do that, and I would encourage people to listen. Do you have a favorite recording yourself?
Well, I'm, among other things, I'm the biographer of Arturo Toscanini, who was the most famous conductor possibly in history. And so his there's one official recording that he made in 1952 when he was very old, and there are several older versions that can be found around. And I like his recordings very much. They're extremely interesting. But there are, as they say, different strokes for different folks. There are versions by conductors like Furtwängler, who was a sort of the opposite pole of Toscanini, much more expansive and, I would say indulgent, but many people would disagree with that completely. There are a lot of recordings, including a lot of modern recordings that are very, very good. So there's an embarrassment of riches, as they say.
All right. There, we'll have to finish it. If you'd like to read more about Beethoven and this work, his book, Harvey Sachs' book, is The Ninth, Beethoven and the World in 1824, published by Random House by our guest Harvey Sachs. He's a writer, music historian, has written for The New Yorker. He is currently on the faculty of the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia. Mr. Sachs, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. The show was first broadcast June 18th. We're sorry we weren't able to do the show we had in the schedule. We were going to talk with David Cloud, national security reporter with the LA Times, about a book he co-authored, The Fourth Star, Four Generals and the Epic Struggle for the Future of the U.S. Army. We'll see if we can get that rescheduled for another day. Coming up in the second hour, Celeste Quinn will be here. She'll be talking with a bioethicist about making tough decisions for someone else, a loved one without the ability to make decisions or with limited capacity for making decisions. Her guest will be Vicky Kind, author of the book The Caregiver's Path to Compassionate Decision-Making.
WILL programs are made possible by Community Concierge Magazine. Every issue includes an event calendar, attractions, and maps, as well as a business and shopping guide. Community Concierge Magazine is distributed throughout East Central Illinois and always presents the Champaign-Urbana area at its best.
Right now, we'll break for an update on the markets, then there'll be more focus, so stay tuned.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated, headquartered in Lafayette, Indiana, with branches in Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois, providing independent commodity, financial, and currency analysis to its clients and newsletter subscribers. On the web at myrmconline.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where prices are firm today, essentially holding on to the gains they saw off the opening bell, maybe a touch softer. Let's look at particulars. In Kansas City, September wheat at 733 and a quarter is up 8 and a quarter. December 748 up 8. September wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 720, up 7. December, 736 and 3 quarters, down 7. September corn, 412, up 5 and 3 quarters. December, 427 and 3 quarters, up 6. March, 440 and a half, up 5 and 3 quarters. July, 453 and a half.